This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Oh, good morning, everyone. So I know there's plenty of disagreement in the world about pretty much everything. But there's one thing I think that absolutely every person has in common. We all have or had a mother. Yes? So today is this celebration in the United States anyway of Mother's Day. And many people think that this is a Hallmark holiday. They sort of poo-poo it. I don't think so. Hallmark might have come along with the cards. And in a way, every day should be Mother's Day, Father's Day, Children's Day, Friends Day. But I think it's a lovely thing that once a year we have this special day that is specifically to say thank you to this person who made it possible for us to be here today. And even if we don't get along with this person, this person still brought you into the world. So there is cause for gratitude. I didn't. Did someone else? Oh, wonderful. Sorry about that. There is no such thing as a coincidence, but it was a lovely thing this morning when Taishin-san asked what sutra I wanted to recite. And I said, oh, you choose, please. And so naturally, he chose the Metta Sutta, which has that wonderful line. Even as a mother, at the risk of her life, watches over and protects her only child, so with a boundless mind should one cherish all living things. So who and what are we celebrating today? Well, there are our personal mothers. What I have to say about that is mine died 6 years ago, and I miss her a lot. And I probably didn't appreciate her enough while she was alive, though I tried to. So if you still have your mother in front of you physically, figure this out now. Forgive her for everything that went wrong and just appreciate that she's your mom. But then, of course, we have Mother Earth. And there's a reason we don't call her Father. Mother Earth is growing things all the time. Mother Earth is nurturing us. Without the mother, the wheat won't grow. The rice won't grow. The beautiful trees here at Jikoji won't survive. And, you know, we are a little bit guilty of not paying attention these days to Mother Earth, and she's trying to tell us in every possible way by completely messing up the climate. Just, hello, here I am, help. Because what we don't understand, we think climate change is just this little tiny thing in the corner. But if the climate begins to change, right now, the Pacific Ocean is warming up by 1 degree. You think, oh, 1 degree. But 1 degree turns out to have huge effect on the other animals that live there that provide food for other animals. And so what we're finding is many animals, mammals and krill and all those, they're moving north. So there's Mother Earth that we need to be aware of. But then today I thought it would be nice to tell you a little of the story of the Buddha's mothers, because he actually had two. He had the mother who gave birth to him, and then the mother who became his mother physically because his mother died. So there is a wonderful book. If you want something just very accessible about the life of the Buddha, there's a book called Old Path, White Cloud. by Thich Nhat Hanh. The first time I read it, I started right at the beginning and started reading it over because it was so well written and with so much history in it and very accessible. So, the dream Siddhartha's mother had before giving birth was this. A magnificent white elephant with six tusks descended from the heavens, surrounded by a chorus of beatific praises. The elephant approached her, its skin white as mountain snow. It held in its trunk a brilliant pink lotus flower, and it placed the flower within the queen's body. Then the elephant, too, entered her effortlessly, and all at once she was filled with a deep sense of ease and joy. She had the feeling she would never again know any suffering, worry, or pain. And she awoke uplifted by a sensation of pure bliss. Pretty nice dream. That morning, the king summoned all the holy men in the capital to come and divine the meaning of the queen's dream. After listening, they responded, "Your Majesty, the queen will give birth to a son who will be a great leader. He is destined to become either a mighty emperor who rules throughout the four directions, or a great teacher who will show the way of truth to all beings in heaven and earth." Siddhartha's mother was Mahamaya, a woman of great virtue. Her love extended to all beings, people, animals, and plants. It was the custom in those days for a woman to return to her parents' home to give birth there. Mahamaya was from the country of Koliya, so she set out for Ramagama, the capital of Koliya. Along the way, she stopped to rest in the garden of Lumbini. Admiring an ashok tree in full bloom, the queen walked towards it, when suddenly, feeling unsteady, she grabbed a branch of the ashok tree to support her. Just a moment later, holding the branch, Queen Mahamaya gave birth to a radiant son. 1 week later, a holy man named Asita paid a visit to the palace. His back was bent with age, and he needed a cane to descend the mountain from where he lived. King Suddhodana personally came out to greet him. He ushered him in to see the baby prince. The holy man gazed at the baby for a long time without uttering a word. And then he began to weep, his trembling body supported by his cane. Streams of tears fell from his eyes. King Suddhodana grew alarmed, and he asked, "What is it? Do you forebode some misfortune for the child?" Master Asita wiped the tears from his head and shook his head. "Your Majesty, I see no misfortune at all. I weep for myself, for I can clearly see that this child possesses true greatness. He will penetrate all the mysteries of the universe. Your Majesty, your son will not be a politician. He will be a great master of the way. Heaven and earth will be his home, and all beings his relations. I weep because I will pass away before I have a chance to hear his voice Proclaim the truths, he will realize. After having attained sublime joy, giving birth to Siddhartha, Queen Mahamaya died 8 days later, and all the kingdom mourned her. King Suddhodana summoned her sister, Mahaprajapati, and asked her to become the new queen. Mahaprajapati, also known as Gotami, agreed and cared for Siddhartha as if he were her own son. So if something sounds familiar here, when we were bowing and chanting the names of the teachers, the great teachers, you might have heard, first of all, that Buddha was born at Lumbini, but you may have heard us talk about the first woman ancestor, Mahaprajapati. This was the adopted mother of the Buddha. So the sage, Asita, he sees truly. Siddhartha's path is not to become an emperor. He is not going to be this great world leader, which I'm pretty sure his father thought, oh, this is good. This is my successor. Instead, much more important, he is going to be the great teacher for whom this sage has waited his entire life. The Buddha dies, Buddha's mother dies in childbirth. His aunt Mahaprajapati takes on the role and becomes his mother. So what is a mother? Biology may be one part, but the true mother is the one who cares for us unselfishly, day after day, through sickness, through health, through misfortune, through joy, from when we are a little tiny baby to when we are an adult. You hear those motorcycles go by. A week ago, a young man died in a motorcycle accident, and he was 21. And my first thought was actually for his mother. There is no worse experience for a parent than to lose a child. You have raised it, you have borne it, you have worried about it, you have loved it. And now this child is gone. So when Siddhartha was a young man, late teens, he had a charioteer. Wouldn't you like to have a charioteer? I would. Travel down skyline with your charioteer, the horses in front. But mostly he'd been pretty sheltered. He lived with his parents. Probably wasn't a palace in the way you think of a palace now, but his father was definitely the head man of the entire area. They probably were wealthy with cows and yaks and goats and, you know, never suffered anything. And because his father had heard this prophecy, he tried to shield his son from knowledge of the world, surrounding him with only good things. But one day, Buddha, Siddhartha, says to his charioteer, you know, I really want to go to town, get a little bored here. So the charioteer takes him to the central town. And while he's there, he sees three life-changing events, which for us happen all the time. The first thing he sees is someone lying on a pallet with, you know, a white face and or a gray, and their hair is all greasy and they've got a pained expression on their face. And he looks at his charioteer and he says, what is that? Oh, Lord, that is sickness, illness. Whoa. They go a little bit further, and he sees a gentleman with a cane, probably like a Sita, very, very old, bent over, hardly able to walk. What is that? Oh, sire, that is old age. And then he sees this procession going across in front of him. And they are carrying a bier that upon it is a body that is clearly not moving. And he's like, what is that? That is death. They are taking him to the Ganges. And Buddha, as you can imagine, is pretty shocked by all of this, because even when people were ill in the palace, they were probably kept apart from him. And, you know, maybe he had some illnesses, but he didn't think about it in that way. You know, old age, sickness, and death. This is because we have a body. And we need our body. Our body is what holds on to our consciousness. As I say, though, his father has shielded him on purpose, because he really wants him to become the next an emperor, even better, you know, king of everybody. But fortunately, his mother understands that Asita had the right of it. This child is going to go beyond worldly. So in Buddhism, we talk about what's called the three marks of existence. The first one is suffering or dissatisfaction. You're going to have this. And it doesn't have to be a big thing, right? It doesn't have to be that you just got a diagnosis of a brain tumor. It's the distance between what is actually happening and what I want to be happening. So it could be as small as, you know, my ice cream cone is now gone. Oh, the small dissatisfaction, right? Oh, my ice cream cone. Or it could be, this friend doesn't want to talk to me anymore. I want them to, but they're not. Or it could be you have 10 days to live. Well, that's a pretty big dissatisfaction. Like, what? Wait a minute. So Thich Nhat Hanh, the same person who wrote this book, has these five recollections, which I have up on the wall in my guest bathroom so that my Zen students see them all the time. I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape going on. I am of the nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape having ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There is no way to escape being separated from them. My actions are my only true belonging. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground on which I stand. Everything you do matters. Every time you meet someone, your meeting matters. In the beginning, we read that little verse, you know, for kalpas and kalpas, an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect teaching is rarely met with in 100,000 million kalpas. A kalpa is defined as the 100 years of an angel coming down from heaven with a feather, wiping a giant boulder, and then going back to heaven. It takes a long time then to make the boulder disappear. And this is 100,000 million kalpas. But it doesn't say that an unsurpassed, penetrating, perfect Dharma isn't met. It says it's not met in that time. It's not that it's not in front of you. It's that we often don't meet it. We don't meet the person who's in front of us. We don't meet the situation. We don't meet our own consequences. We deflect, we deny, we run away. Instead of saying, yes, I did that. Ah, now what can I do to fix it? Because sometimes I can. The second mark of existence is impermanence. So the fact is, all of you are getting older and you know it. And as you get older, it goes, I can just tell you, it goes faster and faster. It's like, oh my God, it's Sunday again? It was just Sunday. And I can remember. Some of you are, you know, in your 30s and 40s, it looks like. I don't remember that. It's been a really long time. So old age, sickness, and death come for us all. And we are of the nature to die, just like everything else. Even things that seem immensely permanent, you know, like this bamboo floor. It just takes one leak to mess up your bamboo floor. And one earthquake to mess up a whole building. Or a whole mountainside. Or a whole river. Things that seem very permanent, it's an illusion. So our mothers, whether they are mothers of humans, animals, or plants, are there to show us this cycle of our life, of birth, of death, which leads, by the way, to renewal and change. I remember there was a story when Thich Nhat Hanh was still alive and teaching, and you know they were talking about old age and death, and this little boy's mother was a little upset about the whole topic. And the little boy said, but mom, if there's no change, I can't get older. I can't grow up. So we need change. And even if we didn't, it would happen anyway. So there's a very famous teacher in the Zen lineage named Dogen Zenji. And Dogen lived in the 12th century. And he wrote this wonderful thing called the Genjo Koan. And he says, you know, when you ride in a boat and you watch the shore, you might assume that it is the shore that is moving, right? Feels like you're sitting still and the shore is going by. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat is moving. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature permanent. When you practice intimately doing what we did today and return to where you are, right here, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. If you had breakfast this morning, it's still going through your body, being processed, being eaten up by all the little mitochondria. There's a lot going on inside. It may look like nothing's happening, but it is. So he says, this being so, it is an established way in Buddha Dharma to deny that birth turns into death. Accordingly, birth is understood as no birth. It is an unshakable teaching in the Buddha's discourse that death does not turn into birth. And so accordingly, death is understood as no death. Birth is an expression complete this moment. Death is an expression complete this moment. They are like winter and spring. You do not call winter the beginning of spring, nor summer the end of spring. They are just big cycle, beginning and end. This is why in Zen, probably the most iconic calligraphy that you ever see is what's called the Enso. It's one stroke beginning, middle, end. The third mark of existence is called emptiness or interconnection. It is the notion that nothing at all has a separate abiding. We are all connected. You couldn't have gotten here if that weren't true, because there would be no roads. There would be no cars. All of those things had to make it possible for you to get here. It's the people here who are greeting you, and the people here later that you will get to know. Birth is an expression, complete this moment. Death is an expression, complete this moment. This is not nihilism or some idea of being detached from your life. The Buddha actually made this mistake for a short period of time, because at the time of Siddhartha, he leaves the palace after he sees all this stuff. He's like, wait a minute, I really need to find out what's going on here. Just like most of us did when we were in our late teens and early 20s. Goodbye, Mom and Dad. I'm off to find out what's going on. So he finds some friends along the way, five friends. But he goes to every sage who is a name in those days. And what ends up happening is they immediately recognize his wisdom, his understanding, to the point that in a very short period of time, they invite him to share their seat as teacher. But they can never answer his most important question. Why do we have to suffer? So he goes from teacher to teacher. And finally, as I say, he hooks up with these other five young men. And one of the things at the time that is fairly common practice is to mortify the body. That it is the body's constant needs that are getting in the way of the spiritual state of enlightenment. And so there are, the sages who lie on beds of nails. They're the ones who flagellate themselves. There are the ones who go around with almost no clothing on and never take care of themselves. They don't wash. And the Buddha and his five buddies, they all have sort of ascribed to this, to the point that there are actually statues of representing the Buddha during this time, where he is like a child who has suffered a famine. All of his ribs show, the belly is distended, gaunt features. And he is really, of course, exhausted by this. And he sits down. All the friends have gone off to sit under different trees and meditate. But he's dying. He's on the edge of death because he has not eaten, not drunk. And you can only do that for so many days before finally the body gives up. When suddenly a young girl, Sujata, goes by, and she's just milked her goats. And she sees this incredibly emaciated person. Now, she's a young girl on her way to be a woman, probably on her way to being a mother. Because what does she do? She rushes over to the Buddha and she offers him a bowl of her milk. At first, he's not going to take it. Oh, no, First of all, I'm not supposed to, but second of all, if my friends ever found out, that would be a problem. But this is his first enlightenment. He realizes in that moment that he is going to die without understanding the most important truth of all. And so he accepts the bowl of milk and is revived enough. Sujata comes back day after day. And that is his 3 days under the Bodhi tree, where he finally has his great enlightenment and understands about interconnection, about the fact that The body is the body. You are going to suffer in the body. You do not need to suffer in the heart mind. That's a different thing. Detachment is not the same thing as non-attachment. The Buddha was in a state of detachment for a while. Detachment is when you, it has to do with separation, right? The opposite of emptiness, which says there is no such thing as separation. Detachment is separation, the removal of yourself from someone or something, physically, mentally, emotionally. Sometimes it involves withholding emotional support from somebody. Nope, don't want anything to do with that. It can actually also be seen as complete indifference. If you know anything about individuals with narcissism, because narcissism is all about me, what you will find is they have no interest in you. And you are pushed away. It's not even that they're antagonistic or negative. They just don't really care at all. They are indifferent. That is detachment. But what the Buddha was learning was non-attachment. That is a state of heart that is completely open, receptive, tender, readily moved by the experience of others, and inclined towards kindness. Definitely free from indifference. If you meet any kind of spiritual teacher that is indifferent to your pain, run. That is not a pure and understanding. This is a person who emerges and engages with reality sometimes more truthfully and tenderly than anyone you've ever met. The last time I was here, I talked about my tea teacher, Peg. Peg was not my biological mother, but she was my mother. She was old enough to be my grandmother, but she was the person, besides my husband, who absolutely and completely accepted me unconditionally as I was, with all my flaws, with so much kindness and tenderness. So even if your own biological mother is not here, or you don't get along with her, or whatever it is, we're very fortunate because we can have many mothers in our life. They don't have to be the mother that birthed us. They are the one who, like in the sutra, watches over and protects her only child with a boundless mind suffused with love. Nothing is pushed away. Nothing is clung to. A real mother wants you to be out in the world. They don't need you to support them. They are there for you. They are so happy in your successes and so empathic in your sadnesses. They enjoy what is present without needing it to last. They care for others without trying to possess them or have any sense of obligation. They don't need people or things to be other than they are. So just for a moment, think about the person in your life who is that person for you, that mother. Mother Earth gives us everything we need. Just like the Buddha's two mothers, between giving birth to him and then giving him the rest of an amazing childhood. And eventually, by the way, Mahapajapati comes and asks to be ordained by her son. She is the first woman ancestor, starting in the Indian lineage, going to China, going to Japan, going to here. Mahapajapati is our example. She knew her son, understood something very deep. So there are these four Brahma Viharas, but the one I just want to mention is called sympathetic joy. This is rejoicing in the well-being and happiness of others. No matter what happens, even, it's like you and your friend are both vying for the same job, and your friend gets it. To be truly happy for your friend, to be truly happy for your sibling who gets praise from the parent that you haven't gotten. This is sympathetic joy. It is what somebody called a sublime nobility art and intellect, which knows and understands and is ready to help. When we understand that, we can be a mother, each of us, men, women, children. So for those of you who are physical mothers, blessings and honor to you today. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.